picked over was in Vaughn's pocket. He studied the development in Brunswick County and tried to track the maze of offshore companies at work. He recruited Greg Myers to front the attack. He was smart enough to keep her identity away from Myers. He'd been scheming for years, methodically putting his grand plan in place, and there were times when it indeed looked brilliant. Now, Hugo Hatch was dead, and Myers was missing, if not dead too. Cooley had jumped ship and left her all alone. As much as she hated Claudia McDover, she had wished 1,000 times already that she had never agreed to help bring her down. Jo Helen speculated that if Dubose got his hands on Myers, he could make him talk, and quickly. At that point, Cooley became a marked man. Sooner or later, they would suspect her as the informant, and there was no one to protect her. Before prison, Cooley had been a tough guy who carried guns and liked to hang out with small-time mobsters. But his 3 years behind bars changed him. He lost his cockiness, his nerve, and when he got out, he desperately needed money. With no law license and a criminal record, his options were limited. A legal shakedown with a whistleblower seemed the perfect operation for him. Chapter 40. They had no trouble finding the General Aviation Terminal at the Valdosta Regional Airport. As Lacey locked her car, she glanced around one more time and saw nothing suspicious. Gunther was inside, chatting up the girl behind the desk, and he hugged his sister as if he hadn't seen her in years. She did not introduce him to Jo Helen because she did not want to use names.
"No luggage," he said.
"We're lucky to have our handbags," Lacey said. "Let's go." They hurried out of the terminal, past several small planes on the tarmac, and stopped at the same beach Baron Gunther had used to rescue Carlita. Again, he said it belonged to a friend. As the day wore on, they would learn that Gunther had some good friends. Just before she climbed through the small door, Lacey called Ali Pacheco for the latest. He answered immediately, said the grand jury was still in session and working hard, and where in the hell was she? She said they were safe and about to go flying. She'd call later. Gunther strapped them in and climbed into the cockpit. The cabin felt like a sauna, and they were instantly sweating. He started both engines, and the airplane shook from its props to its tail. As he began to taxi, he cracked a window and a slight breeze broke the stifling heat. There was no other traffic and he was cleared for takeoff. As he released the brakes and they lurched forward, Jo Helen closed her eyes and grabbed Lacey's arm. Thankfully, the weather was clear, still hot and sticky, though it was October. October 15th, to be exact. Almost 2 months since Hugo's death. Jo Helen managed to relax as they passed through 5,000 feet. The air conditioner was on now and the cabin was comfortable. The constant roar of the two engines made it difficult to talk, but Jo Helen tried.
"Just curious, where are we going?"
Lacey replied,
"Don't know. He wouldn't tell me."
"Great."
The Baron leveled off at a cruise altitude of 8,000 feet, and the engine noise quieted from a roar to a hum. Jo Helen had spent the past 2 nights in cheap motels, on the run and expecting the worst, and fatigue hit her hard. Her chin dropped to her chest as she fell into a deep sleep. Lacey, with nothing to do, also took a nap. When she awoke an hour later, Gunther passed back a set of headphones. She adjusted her mic and said,
"Hello."
He nodded and kept his eyes forward on his instruments. He said,
"So how you doing, sis?"
"Fine, Gunther. And thanks."
"She okay?"
She appears to be in a coma. Been a rough 2 days. I'll fill you in on the ground.
Whenever. Just happy to help.
Where are we going?
Up in the mountains. I've got a friend with a cabin no one can find. You'll love it.
An hour and a half later, he reduced the throttles slightly and the Baron began a slow descent. The terrain below was far different from the flatland they had covered fleeing from Florida to Valdosta just a few hours earlier. As far as Lacey could see, there were ridges of dark, rolling mountains, already in shades of red, yellow, and orange. They drew closer as Gunther positioned the plane for final approach. She shook Jo Helen's arm and woke her. The runway was in a valley, beautiful hills all around, and Gunther touched it perfectly. They taxied to the small terminal, passing 4 other parked aircraft, all small Cessnas. When he killed the engines, he said,
"Welcome to the Macon County Airport, Franklin, North Carolina."
He crawled out of the cockpit, opened the cabin door, and helped them onto the deck. As they walked to the terminal, he said,
"We'll meet a guy named Rusty, a local who'll take us in. About a 30-minute drive, straight up. He watches some of the cabins around here."
"Are you staying?"
Lacey asked. "Sure. I'm not leaving you, sis. How about this weather? And we're only at 2,000 feet.
Rusty was a bear, with a thick beard and chest and a big smile that seemed to leer a bit at the two attractive ladies. He drove a Ford Explorer that gave every appearance of having spent its entire life on mountain trails. As they left the airport, he asked,
"Are we stopping in town?"
Lacey said, "A toothbrush would be nice." He pulled into the parking lot of a small grocery store.
"Is the cabin stocked?"
Gunther asked.
"Whiskey, beer, popcorn. You want anything else, you'd better buy it."
"How long might we be staying?" Jo Helen asked. She had said little, as if in shock at the change of scenery. "Couple of days," Lacey said. "Who knows?" They bought toiletries, eggs, bread, and packaged deli meats and cheese. At the edge of town, Rusty turned onto a gravel road, leaving the asphalt far behind. He climbed a hill, the first of many, and Lacey realized her ears were popping. He talked nonstop and far too casually as he sped along the edges of cliffs and across wooden bridges with rushing creeks beneath them. As it turned out, Gunther had been there only a month earlier, with his wife, for a week of cool temperatures and early foliage. The men talked. The women in the rear seat just listened. The gravel road yielded to a narrow one of dirt. The final charge uphill was straight and terrifying, and when they topped a ridge, a beautiful lake was before them. The cabin sat snug to its shoreline. Rusty helped them unload their supplies and showed them around the cabin. By the time they arrived, Lacey was expecting some rustic lean-to with outdoor plumbing. But she was very wrong. The cabin was spectacular. An A-frame with 3 levels, decks and porches, a dock over the water with a boat moored at its end, and more modern conveniences than her apartment in Tallahassee. A shiny Jeep Wrangler was parked in a small carport. Gunther said its owner, a friend, had made a mint in hotels and built the place to escape Atlanta's muggy summers. Rusty said goodbye and told them to call if they needed anything. Cell phone service was good, and all 3 had calls to make. Lacey called her apartment manager and asked him to ask her neighbor Simon to take care of Frankie. She called Pacheco and explained that they were hiding in the mountains and were as safe as they could possibly be. Jo Helen called Mr. Armstrong and asked him to watch her house, something he and Gloria did at least 15 hours a day anyway. Gunther, of course, had some deals pending and was frantic on the phone. Slowly, they relaxed. Fresh from the Florida heat, they marveled at the clear, light air. According to an old thermometer on the porch, it was 64 degrees. The cabin, at an altitude of 4,100 feet, had everything but air conditioning. Late in the afternoon, with the sun setting behind the mountains and with Gunther on the phone and pacing along a porch far away, Lacey and Jo Helen sat at the end of the dock, near the small fishing boat, and sipped cold beer from cans. Lacey said,
"Tell me about Claudia McDover." "Wow. Where to start?"
"Day one. Why did she hire you and keep you for 8 years?"
"Well, let's say I'm very good at what I do. After my first divorce, I decided to become a court reporter, and I worked hard at it. I trained with the best, worked with the best, and kept up with the evolving technology. When Cooley found out that Claudia needed a new girl, he pushed me to apply for the job. When I got it, his master scheme fell into place because he suddenly had someone on the inside. Court reporters know everything, Lacey. And when I took the job, I was already suspicious of Claudia. She had no idea, and that made it easier. I noticed some things. Her wardrobe was expensive, but she tried to conceal it. If she had a big day in court with a lot of people around, she would dress down. But a slow day around the office, and she would put on the fine things. She couldn't help it. She loved designer stuff. Her jewelry was always changing. Lots of diamonds and rubies. But I'm not sure anyone else noticed, especially in a place like Sterling, Florida. She spent a fortune on clothes and jewelry, more than you would expect from a person with her salary. She got a new secretary every other year because she didn't want anyone to get too close. She was aloof, distant, always tough, but she never suspected me because I kept my distance. Or so she thought. One day, we were in the middle of a trial and I snatched her key ring. Cooley ran by the courthouse and I gave it to him. He had a full replica made. After a frenzied search, she found the keys near a wastebasket and had no clue they'd been copied. Once Cooley had access to her office, he had a field day. He tapped her phones and paid a hacker to get into her computer. That's how we got so much information. She was careful, especially when she dealt with Phyllis Turbin. She used her desktop for official business and one laptop for personal. Then she had another laptop she used for a lot of the secret stuff. He didn't tell Myers all of this because, again, he was afraid that if something happened to Myers, then the entire operation would be compromised. He fed Myers just enough to convince him to convince you to start snooping around. She took a long sip. They watched the water ripple where the fish were feeding. The clothing and jewelry caught my attention. But when we realized she and Phyllis were jetting here and there, New York, New Orleans, the Caribbean, we knew there was a lot of money coming from somewhere. And all the jets were booked by Phyllis, nothing in Claudia's name. Then we discovered an apartment in New Jersey, a home in Singapore, a villa in Barbados. I can't remember everything. And it was all well hidden, or so they thought. But Cooley was watching.
Why didn't he go to the FBI and leave us out of it?
They talked about it, but neither really trusted the feds, especially Myers. In fact, he said he would not be involved if the FBI was involved. I think they screwed him when he got busted and he was afraid of them. Since the state police have no jurisdiction over the Indians, they finally settled on the plan to involve BJC. They knew you had limited powers, but the investigation had to start somewhere. There was no way to predict how it would unfold, but no one expected dead bodies.
Lacey's phone vibrated beside her. "Pacheco," she said. "I need to take this."
"Sure,"
She walked back toward the cabin and softly said,
Yes.
Where are you?
Somewhere deep in the mountains of North Carolina. Gunther flew us up here, and he's standing guard, sort of.
So he's still involved?
Oh, yes. He's been great.
Look, the grand jury adjourned for the day. It will reconvene tomorrow. We have arrest warrants.
When?
We're meeting now to decide. I'll keep you posted.
Be careful.
Careful? This is the fun part. I think we'll be up all night.
At dusk, they built a fire in a stone pit by the lake and huddled under blankets and old wicker chairs. Gunther found a jug of red wine that Lacey deemed suitable for drinking. She drank a little, Jo Helen even less. Gunther, the teetotaler, sipped decaf coffee and tended the fire. Jo Helen wanted to hear the story of the awful crash and Hugo's death, so Lacey gave her best version. Gunther wanted to know all about Cooley and his astonishing efforts at stalking McDover. Jo Helen talked for an hour. Lacey wanted to know how her brother had survived 3 bankruptcies and was still in business, and Gunther's war stories carried the evening. They dined on ham and cheese sandwiches, white bread, of course, by the fire, and talked and laughed until late in the night. Chapter 41. The first arrests were gifts. Of the 7 golf courses Vaughn owned, his favorite was Rolling Dunes, an exclusive club in southernmost Brunswick County, with picturesque views of the Gulf and all the privacy a serious golfer could want. For a man wary of rituals, he did allow himself a weekly indulgence. Each Sunday morning at 8 a.m., he and his cronies gathered in the men's grill in the Rolling Dunes clubhouse for breakfast and Bloody Marys. The mood was always light-hearted, free-spirited, even boisterous. For men in their 60s and 70s, it was playtime with no women around. They were about to spend 5 hours on a beautiful course, drinking beer, smoking fine cigars, gambling on every hole, cheating when possible, cursing at will, telling raunchy jokes, and doing it all without the interference of caddies or other golfers. Their tee time was always 9 a.m., and Vaughn blocked out 30 minutes before and 30 minutes after. He hated a crowded course, and once fired a starter on the spot when he had to wait 5 minutes for a sluggish foursome ahead of them. The Mayton brothers, Vance and Floyd, bickered constantly and thus had to be separated. Vaughn always played with Floyd. Ron Skinner always played with Vance. On Sunday, October 16th, 4 of the 5 cousins teed off at 9 a.m., oblivious to what awaited them. They were just starting their final round of golf. The 5th, Hank Scully, dropped off his boss at the grill with plans to fetch him in 5 hours. Hank hated golf and usually spent his Sunday mornings by the pool with his wife and her small children. He was driving home, minding his business, driving sensibly and under the speed limit, when a Florida state trooper stopped him on Highway 98. He was less than courteous to the officer, and as he was claiming his innocence to any possible traffic offense, he was informed that he was under arrest for murder. Minutes after being stopped, he was in the rear seat of a patrol car, wearing tight handcuffs. Hole number 4 at Rolling Dunes was a long par 5 with a dogleg to the right. From the tee box, the green was not visible, and it was near the edge of the property, next to a public street that was shielded by trees and thick vegetation. From there, Ali Pacheco and his team watched and waited. When the 2 golf carts rattled their way along the cart path and stopped near a greenside bunker, the agents waited until Vaughn, Lloyd, Vance, and Ron walked onto the green with their putters. They were smoking cigars and laughing when a dozen men in dark suits materialized from nowhere and informed them the game was over. They were handcuffed on the green, led through the trees and vegetation, and whisked away. Their cell phones and wallets were confiscated, but their clubs, keys, and cold beers were left behind in the carts. Their putters, balls, and cigars lay scattered on the green. It would be half an hour before the next foursome arrived on the scene. The mystery of the missing golfers would baffle the club for 24 hours. The cousins were placed in separate vehicles. Allie Pacheco rode in the rear seat with Von Dubose, who, after a few minutes of confinement, said,
"This is a bitch. I was having a good round back there. One under after three holes."
"Glad you enjoyed it," Allie said.
"Mind telling me what this is all about?"
"Capital murder."
"And who is the alleged victim?"
"Too many to remember, right, Vaughn? Hugo Hatch."
He took it calmly and did not say another word. True to their code, Hank Scully, the Mayton brothers, and Ron Skinner rode to jail in complete silence. As soon as they were handcuffed and their cell phones taken, teams of FBI agents raided their homes and offices and began hauling away computers, phones, checkbooks, entire file cabinets, anything that might possibly yield evidence. The Maytons and Ron Skinner ran seemingly legitimate offices with assistants and secretaries. But since it was Sunday, there was no one around to witness the intrusions by the FBI. Hank Scully kept his records in the basement of his home, and his terrified wife and kids watched as grim-faced agents loaded up a rental truck. Von Dubose kept nothing on his person or in his cottage that might implicate him in anything. After being fingerprinted and photographed, the freshly indicted defendants were placed in separate cells. Indeed, it would be months before any one of the five caught a glimpse of another. Vaughn was offered a stale sandwich for lunch. He refused and was led to an interrogation room where Allie Pacheco and Doug Hahn were waiting. He said no to coffee and water and said he wanted a lawyer. Pacheco read him his Miranda rights, but he refused to sign the form acknowledging this. Again, he demanded a lawyer and the right to make a phone call.
"This is not an interrogation, Jack," Allie said coolly. "It's just a chat. Sort of a meet-and-greet session now that we know your real name."
"Fingerprints.
We rammed them through and got a hit from your 1972 arrest for aggravated assault with intent to kill.
Then you were Jack Henderson, part of a gang of good old boys who ran drugs and whores and played the numbers. After you were convicted in Slidell, Louisiana, you decided prison was not for you, so you pulled a pretty slick escape. Ditched the old name, became Von Dubose, and for the past 40 years have done a rather remarkable job of being the invisible man. But the party's over, Jack." "I want a lawyer."
"Sure, we'll get you one, Jack. But not some slick talker you have in mind. Those guys cost a bundle, and as of 9 o'clock in the morning, you'll be as broke as your daddy was when he hanged himself in prison. All your bank accounts will be frozen, Jack. All that money tied up forever, untouchable."
"Get me a lawyer."
Clyde Westbury was given the courtesy of a semi-private arrest. Early Sunday morning, he received a call from an FBI agent, who informed him that the hour had arrived. Clyde told his wife there was a problem at the office and left the house. He drove to the empty parking lot of a shopping center and parked next to a black Chevy Tahoe. He put the car keys on the floorboard, got out, got handcuffed, and took a seat in the rear of the Tahoe. He had not told his wife what was about to happen to him. He simply did not have the guts. Using his office keys, two teams of FBI agents raided the offices at the hotels he managed for Star S, the offshore company. On Monday, all guests would be asked to leave, and all reservations would be canceled. The hotels would be closed indefinitely. As the cousins were finally allowed phone calls, word of the arrests soon leaked. Then it spread like wildfire through the organization. To run or not to run? That was the panicked question the managers asked themselves. Before they could decide, most were under arrest while their offices were practically ransacked by the FBI. In Biloxi, a lawyer named Stavish was walking with his wife into a Catholic church for Sunday Mass when two agents stopped and announced a detour. Once it was made clear that he and his partner had been indicted for RICO violations and that he was under arrest, he was given the choice of handing over the keys to their offices or having the FBI kick in the doors. Stavish kissed his wife goodbye, ignored the stunned looks from his fellow parishioners, and left in tears with the agents for his office. At Treasure Key, four agents found the manager on duty and informed him the casino was about to close. Make the announcement, get everybody out. Another agent phoned Chief Kappel and asked him to come to the casino. It was urgent. When he arrived, 20 minutes later, he was urgently arrested. A squad of U.S. Marshals helped herd the angry gamblers out of the building and into the parking lot. Those staying in the two hotels were told to immediately pack and leave. When Billy Kappel arrived in a rush, he too was arrested, along with Adam Horn and three casino managers. They left the marshals in charge of the chaos, as gamblers, guests, and employees milled about, not wanting to leave, but realizing that locks were being placed on all the doors. Around 3 p.m. on Sunday, Phyllis Turbin was having iced tea on her veranda and reading a book. Her cell phone buzzed with an unknown number. She said hello, and an anonymous caller said, "You've been indicted along with your gal McDover and Von Dubose and about 100 other crooks. The FBI is raiding offices all along the coast, and yours will be next." Using a burner, but one known to the FBI, she immediately called Claudia, who had heard nothing. Claudia called her contact, Hank Scully, but got no answer. Both ladies scanned the internet for news, but saw nothing. Phyllis suggested they take a trip to be on the safe side, and called a charter company in Mobile. A jet was available and could be scrambled in 2 hours. As instructed, the charter company called the FBI. Agents followed Phyllis as she hurried to her secret office in a high-end suburban strip mall near the airport. She entered with nothing but keys in her hands, but exited with two bulky Prada bags. They tracked her as she drove to the General Aviation Terminal at the Mobile Regional Airport. The charter company informed the FBI that the client, a regular, wished to make a stop in Panama City to pick up one passenger, the ultimate destination being Barbados. The FBI, in conjunction with the FAA, instructed the charter company to proceed. At 4:50, the Lear 60 took off from Mobile for the 20-minute flight to Panama City. Meanwhile, Judge McDover sprinted to her favorite condo in Rabbit Run, picked up a few items, stuffed them in a large handbag, and raced to the airport. She was there at 5:15 when the Lear taxied to a stop, and she hurriedly made her way to it. The captain greeted her, welcomed her aboard, then went inside the terminal for the required paperwork. After 15 minutes, the co-captain informed Claudia and Phyllis that there was some weather over the Gulf, and they would be delayed.
You can't just go around it?
Phyllis barked.
Sorry.
Two black SUVs appeared from behind the jet and parked in front of its left wing. Claudia saw them first and mumbled,
"Oh, shit."
After the ladies were handcuffed and taken away, the agents searched the jet. The women had hardly bothered with clothing. Instead, they had grabbed all the goodies they could carry. Diamonds, rubies, rare coins, and stacks of cash. Months later, it would be inventoried and appraised at $4.2 million. When asked how they planned to get it by customs in Barbados, they did not reply. Even more loot was seized in raids at McDover's Rabbit Run condo. When agents finally found her safe room, they were stunned at the cash, jewelry, art, rare books, rare watches, and antiquities. The raid on her home, on the other hand, yielded little in the way of valuable assets. In her office, the agents confiscated the usual list of computers, phones, and files. Phyllis Turbin's office computers were apparently not used for the dirty work. However, the two laptops in her secret office were filled with records of bank accounts, wire transfers, corporate records, real estate records, and correspondence to lawyers in countries famous for being tax havens. The sweep along the panhandle was broad and swift. By dusk Sunday, 21 men and 2 women were under arrest and facing a battery of racketeering charges that would only increase in the coming weeks. Included in that number was Delgado, who was pumping serious iron in a gym when 2 agents spoiled his day. On paper, he worked for a bar owned by a company owned by others, and he was charged with the usual money laundering crimes. Years would pass before his more serious crimes came to light. Chapter 42. Cable news discovered the story around 6 o'clock Sunday evening and seemed unprepared for it. Since the crimes were unknown, as were the defendants, there was little coverage. That changed dramatically with 2 events. News of the closing of the casino, and the discovery by some unknown researcher of the term Coast Mafia. The latter was simply too sensational to ignore. And there were soon live reports from the locked gates of Treasure Key. Lacey and Joe Helen stared at the television with a fascination that bordered on disbelief. The conspiracy was destroyed. The syndicate was busted. The corruption was exposed. The criminals were in jail. The notion of justice was alive. It was overwhelming to even think that they had unleashed these startling events. So much had been lost along the way that it was difficult to feel a sense of pride, at least at that moment. When a breaking story interrupted another report, and the face of Judge Claudia McDover appeared on the screen, Jo Helen put her hands over her mouth and started crying. The reporter gushed on about Judge McDover and her lawyer getting arrested on a private jet as they tried to flee the country. About half the details were right. But what the reporter lacked in veracity, she made up for with enthusiasm. "Are those tears of joy?" Lacey asked.
"Maybe. I don't know right now. I'm certainly not sad. It's just hard to believe."
"It really is. A few short months ago, I'd never heard of those people. And I don't recall thinking much about the casino."
"When will it be okay to go home?"
"Not sure. Let's wait until I talk to the FBI. Gunther had taken the jeep to town in search of red meat and charcoal. He was on the porch now, with ribeyes on the grill and potatoes baking in the embers. He popped in occasionally to catch the latest, but by dark the same stories were being recycled. More than once he said,
"Congratulations, girls.
You've just brought down the most corrupt judge in American history. Cheers.
But they were in no mood to celebrate. Jo Helen was almost certain she would keep her job, though the judge who replaced McDover would be free to hire a new court reporter. If she was thinking about her claim under the whistleblower statute, she never mentioned it. At that moment, such a plan seemed too complicated and time-consuming. That, plus she'd lost her lawyer, the guy who was supposed to know how to navigate the statute. Before dinner, Lacey called Geismar and they compared notes. She called Verna and they talked about the arrests of the men charged with killing Hugo. She called Ali Pacheco, but got no answer. They had not spoken the entire day, and that was fine with her. She suspected he might be rather busy. At 9 on Monday morning, U.S. Attorney Paula Galloway appeared before a federal judge in Tallahassee and requested a series of rulings that would immediately close 37 businesses. Most were in Brunswick County. But the entire panhandle was affected. These included bars, liquor stores, restaurants, strip clubs, hotels, convenience stores, shopping centers, amusement parks, public golf courses, and 3 residential developments under construction. The organization's tentacles stretched into several residential communities, such as Rabbit Run. But because the majority of the properties had been sold to individuals, they would be left alone. Ms. Galloway provided the judge with a list of 84 bank accounts and asked that they be frozen for the time being. Most were related to the businesses, but some were for individuals. Hank Scully, for example, kept $200,000 in a low-yielding CD and about $40,000 in a joint checking account. Both were iced by his honor. A veteran who was very much a team player with Ms. Galloway. Because of the nature of the proceedings, there was no one to oppose her requests. She asked that a certain lawyer with a big firm in Tallahassee be named as the receiver for all companies named so far. The receiver's duties would be extensive. He would assume legal control over all of the businesses that had derived their funding, in whole or in part, from the criminal activities of what was now being properly referred to as the DuBose Syndicate. He would reach back to the beginning of each business and company and reconstruct accurate accounting records. With the aid of forensic accountants, he would attempt to weave together the money trails that tied the enterprises together and track them to the syndicate. Working with the FBI, he would attempt to penetrate the maze of offshore companies set up by DuBose and discover the assets of each. Most important, the receiver would handle the forfeiture or sale of all the properties linked to the DuBose syndicate. 2 hours later, Ms. Galloway held a well-choreographed press conference, something all U.S. attorneys dream of. She faced a crowd of reporters and spoke into a nest of microphones. Behind her were her assistants, including Rebecca Webb and several FBI agents. To her right, on a large screen, were the enlarged mugshots of the 5 cousins and Clyde Westbay. She explained the murder charges against them, said they were already in custody, and yes, she planned to seek the death penalty. Holding off questions until the end, she moved from the murder indictment to the RICO charges. The roundup was still underway, but 26 of the 33 defendants were under arrest. The FBI and her office were in the early stage of the investigation with a lot of ground yet to cover. The criminal activities of the DuBose Syndicate were extensive and well-organized. When she asked for questions, she was bombarded. By noon Monday, the mountain getaway was losing its appeal. They were tired of watching the news, tired of napping, tired of trying to read old books someone else had selected for them, tired of sitting on the deck and soaking up the colors of early autumn, as beautiful as they were. Gunther's buddy wanted his airplane back. Lacey had work to do. And Jo Helen was eager to walk into the Brunswick County Courthouse, knowing that she would never again see the face of Claudia McDover. She couldn't wait to hear the gossip. Most important, in Allie's opinion, the threat to Jo Helen had passed. DuBose had matters far more important than a loose-lipped court reporter to worry about. With all the major players locked away and without phones, it would be difficult for him to get things done. Allie also said the FBI would keep an eye on Jo Helen for a couple of weeks. Rusty picked them up at 2 o'clock, and the ride straight down the mountain was more terrifying than on the way up. Even Gunther felt nauseous by the time they arrived in Franklin. They thanked Rusty, went through the empty rituals of promising to see him again, and took off. Lacey wanted to fly straight home, but that was not possible. She had left her new hatchback in Valdosta and had no choice but to stop there. The flight was rough, with Gunther dodging storms and trying in vain to find a smooth altitude. By the time they landed, Lacey and Jo Helen were rattled and happy to be getting in a car. They hugged Gunther and said thanks and goodbye. They waited until he was airborne and quickly left town. Tallahassee was halfway between Valdosta and Panama City, where Jo Helen had left her car in the Neptune Motel parking lot. As the long drive stretched before them, Lacey had a better idea. They would spend the night in Tallahassee at her place and invite Allie for dinner. Over some pasta and good wine, they would listen to his stories from the past 3 days. They would pump him for the details they were eager to know. Who collared DuBose and what did he say? Tell us about Claudia and her attempted getaway. Who were the other defendants and where are they now? Who was threatening Jo Helen? As the miles flew past, they thought of dozens of questions. Lacey called Allie and asked about dinner. The added bonus was that Jo Helen Hooper would be there.
"So I get to meet the Whistler?"
he asked. "Live and in person."
"I can't wait."
Epilogue. In the days after the arrests and raids, the story was front-page news throughout Florida and the Southeast. Reporters from everywhere scurried about, digging here and there, chasing leads and angling for the latest. The locked gates of Treasure Key became the favorite backdrop for their televised reports. They camped out in Verna's driveway until they were forced to leave, so they retreated to the street in front of her home and blocked traffic. After 2 were arrested, and after they realized Verna had nothing to say, they lost interest and drifted away. Paula Galloway, the U.S. attorney, held daily briefings in which almost nothing new was revealed. Allie Pacheco, speaking officially for the FBI, refused to speak altogether. For a couple of days, the reporters filmed outside McDover's home in Sterling, and in front of the Brunswick County Courthouse. They filmed outside Phyllis Turbin's locked office, as well as the law firm in Biloxi. Slowly, the story went from page 1 to page 2. With the focus on the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, there was little interest in the Board on Judicial Conduct. Indeed, the tiny agency survived the storm while attracting almost no attention. Lacey and Geismar got a few calls from reporters, none of which they returned. Like everyone else, they followed the story in the press and marveled at the amount of misinformation being kicked around. As far as BJC was concerned, the case was closed. Their target was in jail and expected to soon resign. Moving on, though, was difficult, at least for Lacey. She was too emotionally involved in the case to simply close it and open another file. The biggest case of her career was over, but it would consume her life for months to come. She and Pacheco were spending a lot of time together and found it impossible to talk about anything else. 2 weeks after the arrests of Mick Dover and the DuBose gang, Lacey returned to her apartment late one afternoon. She was about to get out of her car when she noticed a man sitting casually on her doorstep, waiting. She phoned Simon, her neighbor, and asked him to take a look. He was already watching. As Lacey approached her apartment, Simon stepped outside to monitor the situation. The man was wearing a white golf shirt and khaki shorts, with a baseball cap pulled low and almost covering his eyes. His hair was short and dyed jet black. As she approached him, he smiled and said,
"Hello, Lacey."
It was Greg Myers. She waved Simon off, and they went inside. As she closed the front door behind them, she said, "I thought you were dead." Myers laughed and said,
"Almost. I really need a beer."
"That makes two of us." She opened two bottles and they sat at the kitchen table. Lacey said, "I don't suppose you've seen Carlita." He laughed again and said,
"Spent last night with her. She's fine. Thanks for rescuing her."
"Thanks? Come on, Myers. Start talking."
"What do you want to know?"
"Everything. Why did you disappear?"
"It's a long story."
"Figures. Start talking." Myers was ready to talk, ready to reinsert himself into the narrative that he had helped to create. He took a long pull on the bottle, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, a clumsy swipe that Lacey had seen before, and began.
"Why did I disappear?" "Two reasons, as it turned out. First, it was a backup plan all along. I knew the FBI would be reluctant to get involved, and as things evolved, I was right. If I vanished, then you and the FBI would believe that DuBose had found me. Another murder, mine, would prompt the FBI to take a second look. I didn't want the FBI in the picture, but we, all of us, soon realized the case would go nowhere without them. Was I right about that?"
"Maybe. Your disappearance certainly made it more interesting, but it didn't exactly change the FBI's decision."
"What did?"
"DNA. We had a blood sample from the scene, and it led to the driver of the truck. Once he was identified, the FBI knew the case could be cracked. They smelled a huge win and came in with guns blazing, so to speak."
"How did you obtain a blood sample?"
"I'll tell you about that later. You said there were two reasons you jumped ship."
"Yes. Well, the second one was far more important than the first. I was on the boat one morning in Key Largo, sort of minding my own business, fiddling with an engine, when the burner in my pocket vibrated. I popped it open, said hello or something like that, and a voice said, 'Myers.' I figured it was Cooley. Then something told me it wasn't. I hung up and called Cooley on another phone. He said, 'No, he had not just tried to call me.' I knew someone had picked up my trail, and that someone was Von DuBose. I went below, erased everything on my laptop, stuffed my pockets with cash, and told Carlita I was walking to the marina to buy some ice. I hung around the marina for half an hour, watching everything, and finally bribed a local to drive me to Homestead. From there, I drifted into Miami and went underground. It was a close call and scared the hell out of me."
"Why did you leave Carlita alone like that?" Another long pull on the bottle.
"I knew they wouldn't hurt her. They might threaten her and frighten her, but I figured she would be safe. It was risky. And I had to convince her, Cooley, you, and maybe the FBI that I was just another casualty. People can be made to talk. Even Carlita and Cooley. It was important that they knew nothing about my disappearance.
You ran away.
Cooley ran away.
And you left the girls behind to deal with the danger.
Okay, it looks that way, but it was far more complicated. I had to either run or catch a bullet. Cooley ran for different reasons. Once I was gone, he figured he had been compromised. He freaked out and hid under a rock.
And now you're back looking for the pot of gold.
Damned right we are. Keep in mind, Lacey, that none of this would have happened without us. Cooley was the brains who put it all together over a long period of time. He's the real genius behind it. He recruited Jo Helen and handled her beautifully. Until, of course, he got scared. As for me, I had the guts to sign the complaint, and came within an inch of paying dearly for it.
So did she.
And she'll get her rewards, believe me. There will be enough for all three of us.
Has Cooley kissed and made up with Jo Helen?
Let's just say they're negotiating. They've been sleeping together for 20 years, off and on, and they understand each other.
Lacey exhaled and shook her head. She had not taken a sip of beer, but his bottle was empty. She got another from the fridge and walked to a window. Myers said,
"Look at it like this, Lacey. Cooley, Jo Helen, and I planned this entire assault on Dubose and McDover. Things went wrong. Your buddy got killed. You got hurt. We're lucky there were no other casualties. Looking back with perfect hindsight, I would not have done it. But it's done, and the bad guys are locked up, and the three of us are still standing. We're in the process of making peace, and we'll eventually have fun splitting the pie."
"I'm sure you've been reading the newspapers."
"Every word."
"So you've seen the name of Ali Pacheco?"
"Oh, yes. Seems to be a hotshot agent."
"Well, we're dating, and I think he needs to hear this story."
"Bring him on. I've done nothing wrong, and I want to talk."
The FBI's investigation into the Dubose Syndicate lasted for another 14 months and produced 6 more indictments. In all, 39 people were arrested, and virtually all were deemed flight risks and held without bond. About half of them were lesser targets who worked for businesses owned by the syndicate, but knew little about the money laundering and nothing about the skimming at Treasure Key. With their bank accounts tied up and their freedom curtailed, and with court-appointed lawyers, they began snagging plea bargains as fast as Paula Galloway could lay them on the table. Within 6 months of the arrest of Von Dubose, about a dozen of his co-defendants had agreed to plead guilty and point their fingers at their bosses. As the government chipped away at the fringes, the noose grew tighter around the necks of the real crooks. But they held firm. None of the 11 managers, except, of course, Clyde Westbay, and certainly none of the 5 cousins, cracked. A soft spot, though, was found outside the syndicate. Gavin Prince, a well-regarded Tapacola with a degree from FSU, decided he had no future in jail. He had been second-in-command at the casino and knew most of the dirty secrets. His lawyer convinced Paula Galloway that Prince was not a crook and could help their case immensely for the right deal. He agreed to plead to 1 count, for probation. According to Prince, each gambling table, blackjack, roulette, poker, and craps, has a cash box that cannot be accessed by the dealer. 90% of the money arrives in the form of cash, which the dealer takes, counts for the benefit of the players and the cameras, stuffs into the cash box attached to the table, and converts to chips. Blackjack tables generate the most cash, roulette the least. The casino never closed,
not even on Christmas Day, and its slowest hour was 5 a.m. At that time, every day, armed guards collected the cash boxes, put them on a cart, and replaced them with empty boxes. They were taken to a fortified room, the official count room, where a team of four professional counters, the count team, went through each box. Each counter had a security guard standing behind him or her, and a camera directly above. Each box was counted four times. There were usually around 60 cash boxes. Prince's mission each morning was to remove box number BJ17 from the highest-grossing blackjack table. He did this by simply taking it off the cart before the cart was rolled into the count room. He never said a word. The guards looked the other way. It was business as usual. With BJ17, Prince stepped into a small room, one without cameras, and placed the cash box in a locked drawer. To his knowledge, there was only one other key, and it belonged to the chief, who visited the casino every day and removed the cash. On average, the cash boxes from the blackjack tables collected $21,000 a day. Though BJ17 was known to do even more business. Prince estimated the box yielded at least $8 million a year. All of it gone and unaccounted for. The surveillance tapes of that table were mysteriously erased every 3 days, just in case someone asked questions, though no one ever did. Who, exactly, might come poking around? They were on tribal land. Prince was one of three supervisors who rerouted the cash to the chief's little drawer. All three were in jail, indicted, and facing lengthy sentences. When he folded, the other two quickly fell in line. All three claimed they had no choice but to facilitate the skimming. They knew the chief was not keeping all of the money, that it was being used to bribe other people and so on. But they worked in a don't-ask-don't-tell environment where they made their own laws and truly believed they would never get caught. None of the three claimed to know anything about Von Dubose. The casino was closed for 3 weeks. With 2,000 people out of work and dividends in jeopardy, the Tapacola hired some expensive lawyers, who finally convinced a judge that they could clean up their act. They agreed to engage a professional management team from Harrah's. With Chief Capel in jail and facing the likelihood of being there for decades, and with the tribe thoroughly humiliated, a recall effort began. 90% of the Tapacola signed a petition calling for his resignation and for a new election. He stepped down, as did his son Billy and their sidekick Adam Horn. 2 months later, Lyman Gritt was elected chief in a landslide. After his election, he made a promise to Wilton Mace to get his brother out of prison. Lawyers for the cousins sought unsuccessfully to loosen up some of their money. They wanted to retain some big league lawyers who could dig for loopholes. The judge, however, was not keen on the idea of allowing tainted cash to be spent on legal fees. He said no. And emphatically, and appointed experienced criminal lawyers to defend them. Though far more serious than the RICO indictment, the capital murder case was easier to prepare. Absent Clyde Westbay, there would be only 5 defendants at trial, as opposed to 20 or so in the RICO case. Paula Galloway had long since decided to push hard for the murder trial, hope for convictions, and with the cousins locked away for either life or death, negotiate aggressively with the remaining RICO defendants. Once everyone was caught and in jail, she and her team believed the murder trial could be set in about 18 months. The RICO trial could take as long as 2 years to put together. In April 2012, some 6 months after the arrests, the court-appointed receiver began selling assets. Using an infamous and controversial federal statute, he organized an auction for 9 late-model automobiles, 4 boats, and 2 twin-engine airplanes.